Imagine a space for South Asian women where stories are not just told, but actually felt. This is Rue, Rising Over Obstacles and Healing, brought to you by Jyoti and Monica, two friends who set out to carve a little space and make a difference by sharing stories and fostering healing and strength within our community. We invite you to listen and reflect, finding your own path one story at a time. And just for sticking around, there's a golden biscuit at the end of each episode. Hi, so today on Rue, we're shifting our focus to the practical steps of self-protection and empowerment. My guest is the incredible Ravi Khatri, an experienced attorney who specializes in matrimonial and family law. Ravi knows the specific legal and cultural obstacles South Asian women often face when considering a separation or divorce. She's here to cut through the confusion and share clear, critical advice on how you can secure your rights, protect your future, and gain the knowledge you need to take control of your life. Welcome to the show, Ravi.
Hi, Jyoti. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to talk about this very serious topic and actually enlighten our listeners about all their rights.
Yeah, because I find that there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of misinformation that's out there, and it's trying to navigate. I mean, first of all, just the thought of separating from your partner as a South Asian is daunting, and there's so many complexities to that. Aside from just your immediate family, you think about what others are going to say, and there's so many factors that come into play. But then just even navigating this road of trying to separate, trying to get a divorce, it's quite complicated. So I'm glad that you're able to come on and just give us some knowledge. So first of all, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I am a Punjabi. I was born in India, moved here when I was six, and I am the first lawyer in the family. You know, I'm actually the first person in my family on both sides to pursue any degree higher than college. So I didn't have, you know, anybody showing me the way. I sort of, you know, blazed my own trail. And yeah. I started out just trying different types of law. And I accidentally fell into matrimonial because I was really looking for something people-based, something where I wanted to actually help people and interact with people. I was like, the last thing I want to do is sit around doing paperwork all day, even though I still do lots of paperwork. And so this was, it was an accidental thing for me. And then eventually I joined a firm, then I became a partner, and I'm actually, you know, have my own firm now. And a lot of the people that I represent tend to be immigrants because my firm is based in Queens, New York, which is a massive hub of, you know, immigration and just so many different cultures.
Yeah. I mean, isn't Queens like literally the melting pot of the world, right? That's what I always hear because it's just so diverse.
Yeah, I think they call it the world's borough. So, you know, it's definitely, you know, I think you can find any type of culture, any type of person, any of any background here. And you know, that's what makes Queens great and New York great in general. But yeah, it also, when we start litigating and I start going through questions of divorce, it creates a lot of difficulty sometimes because people just aren't aware of what their rights are.
Yeah. No, I can only imagine. I'm glad that you tried all the different types of law and you happen to enjoy family and matrimonial law, because I think it really is helpful for South Asian women to have someone like you on to be able to share all the wisdom and knowledge that you have. So let's get started. I just want to know, like, when a woman is feeling pressured to stay or is actively considering divorce, what are the first one or two confidential steps she should take before even speaking to her spouse or her family?
I think the first step should always be consulting an attorney to find out what your rights are. And I think a really important thing for everyone to know is that when you consult an attorney, that creates an attorney-client relationship. So anything you discuss with that attorney is what's called privileged, and they cannot share any of that information with anybody else. So that conversation is completely private.
Isn't it something like you could retain the attorney for even like a dollar or something as long as there's money exchanged? Is that true? Like, do you have to exchange money in order for this to be that attorney-client privilege, or even just starting a conversation?
Just starting a conversation will create that privilege, because once they start knowing any details about your relationship with your spouse, that basically cuts them off from being able to represent your spouse in divorce proceedings. So you can't have the same attorney if there's going to be a litigation. And there's okay. certain cases where you can, but, you know, just right now, if we're just doing a straightforward divorce, it's just about making sure that you retain somebody or just consult with somebody who knows the law, because mm-hmm. the law that's going to be in your state, I practice in New York, but in any state where you live, is going to be completely different from back home.
Yeah, that is true. So how would one go about finding an attorney that they can trust, that they know is someone who's going to be able to help them?
That's always the hardest part, is trying to find yeah. somebody who you may be able to speak to. And mm-hmm. one recommendation I have is, and I've gotten a couple of clients like this, is going to the Gurdwara, mm-hmm. because the people there who, you know, who are supposed to be there to support you are actually realizing that there are cases and instances where they need to refer people out to attorneys. And because mm-hmm. they're in bad situations, and, you know, trying to, you know, prey on it isn't going to resolve this, that you need to take more action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another option is just if you happen to know somebody who has gone through a divorce, you know, just asking for a referral. Or the worst case situation is contacting your local bar association. So bar okay. association is made up of lawyers, and they can sometimes refer you to attorneys in a specific area. And they also have a list of people who may speak the language that you speak, if English is not your first language or just not something that you're fully comfortable with.
That's helpful, actually, to know. But I want to go back to the client attorney privilege, because I find that a lot of times, as Desis, we are so wary of sharing like our confidential information with anybody. Because to me, it makes sense that, you know, let's say you're considering going down this path and you contact an attorney who is South Asian, you know, perhaps knows the language, and you can easily converse with the attorney in your language that you're comfortable speaking in. That attorney is going to most likely know other people that you know. And a lot of times, I think we're distrusting when it comes to sharing this information for the fear that, oh, now this attorney is going to go ahead and share it with everybody else in the community. So how serious do you take the confidentiality? As an attorney, are there any legal repercussions if you were to share confidential information with someone else?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, our license is at risk if we start divulging information about clients to anybody who isn't the client. You know, so mm-hmm. when you walk into an attorney's office, you know, you can be very confident that they're not going to go about discussing this with anybody else who is in the community, because why would anybody risk their license for one case? But no, absolutely not. You know, if I discuss cases with other attorneys to, let's say, get advice, I never mention names. I never try to give details that are going to be identifying, because, you know, you do need to discuss sometimes with colleagues, but never in a situation that's going to put somebody's information at risk or their, you know, their personal details at risk, because that breaks down attorney-client privilege, but also it hurts your reputation in the yeah. legal community. And it also, like I said, puts an attorney's license at risk.
Yeah, that makes sense. So now, a lot of times as a South Asian woman, before you even consider separation or a divorce, a lot of times you're subjected to like emotional abuse and intimidation. There's financial abuse that comes into play. So how does the American legal system define and address emotional and financial abuse, which, as we know, it's quite prevalent in our culture?
Obviously, physical abuse is, you know, something that's easily understood and recognized in the legal system. But we're definitely starting to get to a point where the courts are starting to understand, okay, that emotional abuse is a form of domestic violence, as is financial control, because without financial control, you really can't do anything. And I can't really speak to, you know, anything outside of New York, but in New York City especially, there is a growing understanding regarding that this is a form of domestic violence. And it started to create criminal repercussions for people based on these. So those are, you know, can be a little bit harder to prove in a criminal case, but in a family court case, to get an order of protection regarding these things and to explain to a court, hey, this is also domestic violence that I've been enduring for many years, that's becoming more and more prevalent. And unfortunately, what I've really seen in my experience is that the emotional abuse and the financial abuse is not far removed from the physical abuse. It's rare that you see one without the other. There's usually some sort of physical violence amongst these issues.
Mm-hmm. So for someone who's listening and isn't aware of what financial abuse actually is, like, how would you define it?
Anybody experiencing financial abuse would be you don't have access to your own money. You know, I think that's the easiest way to define it. But you also don't have access to the family finances. So you don't understand or know, let's say, how much the mortgage is each month. How is it getting paid? Where does your husband's income come from? You know, or even things like health insurance, not knowing how to access your bank account or be able to even take out money from the joint bank account without your spouse or your partner asking questions about where you spend it. Or giving up your job, I think, is another one. It's like if you have children, you suddenly become a stay-at-home parent, your spouse is the one completely controlling all of the finances.
So if someone chooses to stay home after having kids and is running the household, raising the kids, taking care of everything that needs to be done at home, but isn't working, the husband is the only one working and he's controlling all the finances. And let's say you have no access to the money that's in the account, that's financial abuse.
Absolutely.
Okay. And what are some of the protections in place for someone who may be experiencing this?
So the one good thing of doing a divorce, at least in New York State, is that there is mandatory financial disclosure. So if you file for divorce in New York, minimally, the last 3 years of finances from the date that you filed for divorce are completely open book. So even if at the time that you go seek legal advice or you go file for divorce, you don't have all the financial information like your husband, your spouse's income or retirement benefits, things like that, those must be disclosed in a divorce. And it's rare that people can actually hide all of that information, because usually an abuser doesn't expect their spouse to be able to find a way out. So they don't think they need to hide anything. They just think they have to maintain the control of it. But once you get into court or just filing a divorce and you have attorneys involved, you're going to be required to produce all of those documents and you will eventually get that information.
So for a woman who's been kept out of like financial decisions, what are like the top three essential documents that she needs to discreetly locate and gather to even begin building her case?
Always tax returns, any proof of income for you or your spouse, and a bank statement. You know, I'd say just something as recent as you can get. It's pretty easy to just be able to take a picture of the bank account or a bank statement if it's sitting at home, or the tax returns. The problem you sort of have now is that everything is so easily digitized and everybody is just paperless.
Yeah.
But if you, let's say you are on the joint bank account, you can just walk into a branch and say, I would like to see the balance on my account. And as long as you have an ID, even if you don't have the debit card, you will be able to at least get the bank balance.
Mm-hmm.
And even sometimes the last few transactions, they'll be able to give it to you.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. Now, so how does it work in, I know you can't speak to other states, but in New York, when you're going through a divorce, is it 50-50? Like all the assets, is that how they're divided?
So New York State believes that a marriage is an economic partnership. So if you're staying at home, taking care of the kids, maintaining the household while your spouse goes and works, you're entitled, anything you obtain between the date of marriage and the date you file for divorce, regardless of whose name it is in, is subject to be divided. It's not always 50-50, but anything marital is, there's a lot of, you know, qualifications when you start looking at assets, but it's pretty much a 50-50 state in terms of what's acquired during the marriage. So I'll have a lot of clients will come in and say, well, I've been married for 15 years. We live in this house, but it's in my spouse's name. Mm-hmm. And the first question is always, when did you buy the house? Mm-hmm. And if it was during the marriage, it's most likely that it's going to be split. The equity in the house is going to be split 50-50.
Okay. That's good to know. How does it work when it comes to cultural assets like gold jewelry or gifts or anything that was given like at the time of the wedding?
So anything given as a gift is considered the property of the recipient. So if, you know, you're the wife and your family gifted your husband gold during the at the wedding ceremony, that's his. Mm-hmm. Anything that's gifted to you is yours. Anything you purchase generally during the marriage, it's coming out of marital monies, usually belongs to the person who wears it more often. You know, I haven't really had too many cases where people are fighting over jewelry, but it'll, you know, generally the first thing that people sort of, you know, especially in South Asian culture is, okay, well, what's going to happen to my gold? And it's like, well, you know, it tends to be yours.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. So any gold that was given to your spouse or spouse's family stays with them. Gold that was given to you is yours. Anything that was purchased or acquired after the marriage is shared, basically.
Pretty much, you know, sometimes it's the value of the item bought, but also it's like, well, okay, it's a necklace that's worn by women. Why is your husband trying to make a claim for it? And the courts kind of see that as something sort of petty sometimes to fight over. So if the husband is trying to make a claim for it, you know, or they might try to claim, well, you know, I bought this gift to my mother is one I've seen a couple of times. I was like, well, why is your wife wearing it in these pictures if you bought it for your mother?
And, you know, it seems petty, but have you seen the price of gold these days?
I just watched a segment on the news this morning about how the price of gold has significantly increased. So,
I mean, it's insane.
It's not. Yeah, it's almost as, you know, valuable as, you know, retirement assets.
Yeah. I hear it from my mom all the time. She's like, you should have let me buy you more gold when you were getting married. You know? You know, it was like a time when I was like all into silver jewelry. I didn't want anything gold. And, you know, whatever she bought me, it was a lot of reluctance on my part.
Exactly. You know? I know, same. But I was like, now I just look at my mom's gold jewelry. I'm like, oh, mom, that's really nice, actually.
Yeah. So now when it comes to like international assets, right, what is the complexity of dividing or addressing these assets like property back home, or if there's any bank accounts that are owned by the family, like back in the home country? How does that work?
So in at least New York, and I'd say generally in the United States, once a court has power over you to make decisions regarding your divorce, they have control over every single asset you own to distribute it, whether it's located here, in Florida, in Canada, or in India.
Mm-hmm.
So once they decide, okay, who gets what property or who gets what assets, sometimes, you know, if one person wants to, let's say, keep a property in India, what they'll try to do is offset it with what may be here in America or in the state that you live in to make it easier. And if you can't sort of divide it out to sort of offset assets that are located here with assets that may be located in another country, depending on who wants what, what you would do is get an order. Let's say you own property in India and the mm-hmm. court says you have to sell it and divide the proceeds. What you would have to do is take that order from an American court, take it to a court in India, transfer it and make it into an Indian order. And you would have to hire an attorney in India to enforce it, because the biggest problem is always, yes, the court says you have to do this, but will the other spouse be willing to do it? Mm-hmm. And then you need to have a court in whatever jurisdiction this other property is located be able to have power over either the property or the person at any time when they're there. And you may need to sort of potentially have your lawyers in two countries at once to get the property dealt with in accordance mm-hmm. with the divorce decree that's in America.
Okay, got it. And now, like, this leads me to, like, let's say you've divided all the assets and whatnot, but you're a stay-at-home mom and you're not, you know, obviously you're not working. How is alimony, like spousal support, determined? Like, is it based on the spouse's salary and is it a certain percentage that you receive?
So in New York, there is a formula set by the state, and that is based on both parties' incomes. And it's not income in the way that you would report on your taxes. It's mm-hmm. not your ability to earn, because I'm sure you wouldn't be surprised to know, but as soon as somebody starts going through a divorce, suddenly they don't make the income that they used to. Suddenly mm-hmm. they've lost their job or they've been demoted, or if they make their own money and they have their own business, suddenly business isn't so good, even though mm-hmm. they're not spending any differently. So mm-hmm. New York considers it about your ability to earn. So if you, in the 3 years leading up to the divorce, were making $300,000 each year and suddenly we're here mm-hmm. filed for divorce and now you only make $100,000, the court's going to be like, unless something seriously caused you to have a massive reduction in income, your yeah. spousal support obligation is going to be calculated at the $300,000 level.
Mm, got it. Regardless of what they're showing for that year.
Correct. And then in New York, there is the number of years that you're entitled to spousal maintenance is going to depend on the length of your marriage. So the longer you're married, anything over 15 years, you're entitled to about 50% of the length of the marriage.
Oh, wow. Okay. So if you've been married 15 years, then you'll get spousal support for 7.5 years, basically.
Yes. And your spousal support obligation is separate from child support.
Okay. Yeah. So child support would be for the children that you have in the marriage.
New York State, same way they have a calculation for spousal support, has a calculation for child support. And that is going to be based on the number of children. It's a percentage. So one child is 17%, two children is 25%, three is 29%. 4 is 31%, and then 5 or more is 35% of your income. There's some deductions that are allowed in there mm-hmm. when making the calculation. And once again, it's based on both of your incomes. And, you know, if the other spouse who's paying spousal maintenance is also paying child support, they'll take the spousal maintenance obligation also into account when they're calculating child support. And the important thing to know in New York is that while custody ends at 18 when a child becomes an adult, child support goes to 21.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. And how does the custody part of it work?
In pretty much any state you go to, the most important thing that the courts consider is what's in the best interest of the child. So everybody's going to come into court, you know, claiming, hey, I'm the better parent. But at the mm-hmm. end of the day, what the court's going to look at is who's been the primary caregiver, you know, who gets them ready for school, who goes to school with the kids, who is responsible for their day-to-day things like, you know, making them lunch, making mm-hmm. sure they go to doctor's appointments, mm-hmm. taking them on play dates, who does homework with them, who's reading with them. All mm-hmm. of those things are what's going to be most important. And frankly, at the end of the day, the courts aren't really going to care, you know, how each parent's feeling, because their paramount concern is always protecting kids, especially when there are allegations of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And it's not just domestic violence committed against a child. If a parent is committing domestic violence against the other parent, the court's going to take that into consideration because they're not going to give custody to somebody who is making the other parent's life difficult because you're becoming the reason why there's acrimony in this house. And I think the one thing people don't always realize is that no matter how young the child is, they really pick up on everything. Yeah. You know, it's really, you know, it's kind of sad that sometimes, you know, people think, hey, we'll stay in either this marriage or this relationship for longer because there's kids involved. Mm-hmm. But those kids sometimes are sort of forced to grow up a little bit faster because they are seeing these very adult situations that they shouldn't have to deal with. And they are actually, you know, you're actually going to be better off taking yourself and your child out of that situation because you don't want to sort of take away their childhood from them. And it's just so easy to get caught up in trying to protect kids and you just don't realize that actually it's already too late. They already know too much because they hear everything, they see things. And children, I'd say generally, are very, very perceptive.
Yeah, no, they absolutely are. And I think so many women tend to stay, and not just women, I'm sure men too, tend to stay in a toxic marriage because of the kids. And what they don't realize is that staying in that marriage actually has more of an adverse effect on the children as opposed to if they were to just part ways and have more of an amicable separation.
Absolutely. Sometimes in these toxic situations and marriages, the kids see things and say things and repeat things to school that are going to potentially create legal obstacles for both parents. Mm-hmm. If the children, you know, say, hey, I saw mom hit dad or dad was chasing mom with a knife and I saw that and repeats it to a teacher, you know, these could create child protective service investigations. Mm-hmm. And especially if, you know, a kid shows up with a bruise, schools are mandatory reporters. So it doesn't matter where you are, they're absolutely calling the police and causing investigation. And that creates a whole new ball game for everybody because even if you're not the parent that committed the crime, if you stay in that relationship long enough and that your child faces significant abuse, you could also be charged with neglect in some states.
Even if you're not the parent who's committing the aggressor.
It. Correct. Yeah. So, you know, I think there is an understanding that if one parent is doing it, that the other parent has to at least try and do something to get out. And there are a lot of ways to be able to get out. I think we're lucky in New York, and I think in the United States as a whole, that we're able to have charities, have programs that can assist people who are victims of domestic violence.
And yeah.
I actually just was, before we spoke, reading about a new bill that was just passed in New York City that allows for free advice, legal advice for people of domestic violence, that, you know, through the Legal Aid Society and a couple of other organizations. And there's actually a lot of those out there. So, you know, if you just Google it, you know, you'll be able to at least find somewhere that you can get accurate legal advice about how to help yourself and how to help your family.
I was actually just looking and I saw that there's quite a few South Asian ones as well. So I believe the one in New York is Saki.
Yeah.
And they can actually assist you in getting legal representation, finding housing, and all kinds of resources. So it's job. Actually.
Yep. Yeah. They also provide job training and classes. They will help you apply for benefits while you are able to go through your divorce and get financial support from your spouse. So there are incredible. And they also offer therapy. They also, which is really, really important. And I think regardless of whether or not you're going through domestic violence or if it's just a relationship that didn't work, sometimes you just need a professional to talk to. Yeah. And while I, as your lawyer, will listen to a lot of things, there are much more qualified people to give you actual advice as to how to deal with your emotions, how to discuss, you know, this with your family. Because I think the concern always, especially in the Desi community, is, you know, Loki Kanagi.
Yeah.
You know, what will people say? It's always about what will people say, because we're brought up in a culture where we're supposed to respect the advice of our elders, their viewpoints, and follow a certain path. But that path doesn't always work for everybody. And we need to come to terms with how are we going to discuss the fact that this marriage didn't work.
Yeah.
And it's not always just because somebody's a bad person. It's sometimes just because, you know, you were young, you fell into a situation that just didn't work out. And instead of everybody being unhappy, let's find a new way forward.
Yeah, I love that you said that, because I think a lot of times people think, well, circumstances have to be extremely dire to consider a divorce. But, you know, if your day-to-day life is miserable and you're not happy, it doesn't necessarily have to be domestic abuse. When you're not happy, essentially you're not filling your own cup. So how are you able to fill anyone else's cup? You're not able to take care of your loved ones, your family, the best that you could, because you're not happy in this relationship. So why subject everyone to that? Why not just, you know, like I said before, part ways amicably and show your kids that it's okay, you know, you're still going to love them just as much. And if anything, now they just won't be subjected to the toxic environment that gets created when two people are living under one roof and they can barely tolerate one another.
Yeah, and I think it's really hard for people to sort of take that time to appreciate that they're not happy, because we're in a society where we don't have time to think about anything. We're just like, gotta go, go, go.
Autopilot.
Like, at least, exactly. It's like, well, you know, the kids have these activities. I've got work. We got to cook dinner. We have these family obligations, all of these things. And you're like, you know, and you just go through the motions for so long. And what I've actually started noticing a lot lately is people, as kids get older and people have to, spouses have to sort of spend more time with each other, they kind of realize, hey, maybe I wasn't so happy all along. And especially in our culture, we're not taught to prioritize our own happiness.
Yeah.
And that's difficult. And because you're always supposed to put family first. You know, you can't put family first if you just can't get your head around being happy for yourself and just being in a position of taking care of yourself physically and mentally to just realize what's going on here.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to, you know, I guess maybe because I spent so much time talking divorce with everybody that I, you know, for me, it's normalized.
Yeah.
But I think people should realize that, hey, sometimes you just need to realize that it's okay. Everybody fights in marriages. That's normal. But if you're just not happy and you can't find a middle ground with a person that you're supposed to be sharing the rest of your life with, it's okay to take a step back and just say, hey, we're not happy here. Maybe we should try something else.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. The flip side of it, I think also, is that, you know, we've been sold the whole Bollywood romance, you know, as they see kids growing up. I think, you know, kuch kuch hota hai, dilwale dulhania le jayenge, you know, like, I think we all just sort of, that's the kind of love that I think we all aspire to have. And I think that we also have to be realistic about our expectations. A lot of times I find that nowadays, actually, people are just not even giving the relationship a real shot, because their expectations are set so high. You know, it's just like, you have to understand that it's not always going to be a bed of roses. It's not, you know, you're going to have your ups and downs, and you're not always going to have those butterflies in your stomach. You're not always going to, you know, hear music in the middle of the night.
Yeah, you're not always going to have, you know, Shah Rukh Khan in the Vazna Le Jange trying to convince your entire family that he's the right guy for you, you know?
Exactly.
And I think, you know, right, and you're absolutely right. The alternate side of this, like, not the first moment that you feel a little bit of unhappiness or discomfort, should you just go running to a divorce attorney?
Yeah.
Divorce is a big step. It's very easy to get married. Getting divorced is significantly more complicated and takes more time.
Thank you, Ravi, for coming on and sharing all this information. It's been very helpful. You know, typically we do stories and we talk about what someone's going through, obstacles that they've overcome. And I think every once in a while, it's important to have episodes that just give out information. So I know it was a lot of information. And, you know, if someone is considering this next step, then this would be sort of a resource for that person. We'll include your information in show notes. So if someone does need to reach out to you, they'll know where to find you. And again, thank you so much for coming on.
Of course. I was really excited to talk about this because I love talking about what I do and I really want to help people. And, you know, it does, there's lots of stresses of being a lawyer, but at the end of the day, I know I'm helping people and I'm going to, you know, leave the listeners with what I always tell all my clients. I know this was a lot of information. It's going to take you time to absorb it all. But if you have any questions, give me a call.
Thank you so much. I can tell that you love what you do. You're passionate about it. It comes through. And I think for someone who is considering this, you would be someone who would be willing to hold this person's hand and walk them through it. And not because you have to, but because you would want to. So thank you. And we'll be back next week.
Thank you for listening to Rue. We appreciate you joining us as we cultivate a community of strong, empowered women, one story at a time. If you or someone you know has a story you'd like to share, please contact us at ruedaraz@gmail.com. That's ruedaraz@gmail.com. Also, do us a favor and please share this podcast with your sisters, your mom, your friends, aunties, your eyebrow lady, like any lady you know. You know, you get the idea. Till next time, kush raho, be well.